Richard had met Jessica in France on a weekend break in Paris 2 years earlier, had in fact discovered her in the Louvre while trying to find the group of his office friends who had organized the trip. Staring up at an immense sculpture, he had stepped backwards into Jessica, who was admiring an extremely large and historically important diamond. He tried to apologize to her in French, which he did not speak, and so gave up and began to apologize in English, and then tried to attempt to apologize in French for his having to apologize in English, until he noticed that Jessica was about as English as it was possible for any one person to be, by which time she had him buy her an expensive French sandwich and some overpriced fizzy apple juice by way of apology. And, well, that was the start of it all, really. He had never been able to convince Jessica that he wasn't the kind of person who went to art galleries after that. On weekends, when they did not go to art galleries or to museums, Richard would trail behind Jessica as she went shopping, which she did, on the whole, in affluent Knightsbridge, a short walk and an even shorter taxi ride from her flat in a Kensington mews. Richard would accompany Jessica on her tours of such huge and intimidating emporia as Harrods and Harvey Nichols, stores where Jessica was able to purchase anything from jewellery to books to the week's groceries. Richard had been awed by Jessica, who was beautiful and often quite funny, and was certainly going somewhere. And Jessica saw in Richard an enormous amount of potential, which, properly harnessed by the right woman, would have made him the perfect matrimonial accessory. If only he were a little more focused, she would murmur to herself, and so she gave him books with titles like Dress for Success and 125 Habits of Successful Men, and books on how to run a business like a military campaign, and Richard always said thank you and always meant to read them. In Harvey Nichols' men's fashion department, she would pick out for him the kinds of clothes she thought that he should wear, and he wore them during the week anyway. And a year to the day after their first encounter, she told him she thought it time that they went shopping for an engagement ring. "Why'd you go out with her?" asked Gary in corporate accounts 18 months later. "She's terrifying." Richard shook his head. "She's really sweet once you get to know her." Gary put down the plastic troll he had picked up from Richard's desk. "I'm surprised she still lets you play with these." "The subject has never come up," said Richard, picking up one of the creatures from his desk. It had a shock of day-glow orange hair and a slightly baffled expression, as if it were lost. The subject had indeed come up. Jessica had, however, convinced herself that Richard's troll collection was a mark of endearing eccentricity, comparable to Mr. Stockton's collection of angels. Jessica was in the process of organizing a traveling exhibition of Mr. Stockton's angel collection and had come to the conclusion that great men always collected something. In actuality, Richard did not really collect trolls. He'd found a troll on the street outside the office, and in a vague and pretty vain attempt at injecting a little personality into his working world, he had placed it on his computer monitor. The others had followed over the next few months, gifts from colleagues who had noticed that Richard had a penchant for the ugly little creatures. He had taken the gifts and positioned them strategically about his desk, beside the telephones and the framed photograph of Jessica. Today, the photograph had a yellow post-it note stuck to it. It was a Friday afternoon. Richard had noticed that events were cowards. They didn't occur singly, but instead they would run in packs and leap out at him all at once. Take this particular Friday, for example. It was, as Jessica had pointed out to him at least a dozen times in the last month, the most important day of his life. Not the most important day of her life, of course. That would come one day in the future, when, Richard had no doubt, they would make her Prime Minister or Queen or God. But it was, without question, the most important day of his life. And so it was unfortunate that, despite the post-it note Richard had left on his fridge door at home and the other post-it note he had placed on the photograph of Jessica on his desk, he had forgotten about it completely and utterly. Also, There was the Wandsworth report, which was overdue and taking up most of his head. Richard checked another row of figures, then he noticed that page 17 had vanished, and he set it up to print out again, and another page down, and he knew that if he were only left alone to finish it, if, miracle of miracles, the phone did not ring, it rang. He thumbed the speakerphone. "Hello, Richard? The managing director needs to know when he'll have the report." Richard looked at his watch. 5 minutes, Sylvia. It's almost wrapped up. I just have to attach the P&L projection." "Thanks, Dick. I'll come down for it." Sylvia was, as she liked to explain, the MD's PA. And she moved in an atmosphere of crisp efficiency. He thumbed the speakerphone off. It rang again, immediately. "Richard," said the speaker, with Jessica's voice. "It's Jessica. You haven't forgotten, have you?" "Forgotten?" He tried to remember what he could have forgotten. He looked at Jessica's photograph for inspiration and found all the inspiration he could have needed in the shape of a yellow post-it note stuck to her forehead. "Richard, pick up the telephone." He picked up the phone, reading the post-it note as he did so. "Sorry, Jess. No, I hadn't forgotten. 7 p.m. at Ma Maison Italiano. Should I meet you there?" "Jessica, Richard, not Jess." She paused for a moment. "After what happened last time, I don't think so. You really could get lost in your own back garden, Richard." Richard contemplated pointing out that anyone could have confused the National Gallery with the National Portrait Gallery, and that it wasn't she who had spent the whole day standing in the rain, which was, in his opinion, every bit as much fun as walking around either place until his feet hurt. But he thought better of it. "I'll meet you at your place," said Jessica. "We can walk down together." "Right, Jess. Jessica, sorry. You have confirmed our reservation, haven't you, Richard?"
"Yes,"
lied Richard earnestly. The other phone on his desk had begun to ring shrilly.
"Jessica, look, I..."
"Good," said Jessica, and she broke the connection. The largest amount of money Richard had ever spent on anything had been spent on Jessica's engagement ring, 18 months earlier, at one of Harrod's many jewellery concessions. He picked up the other phone.
"Hi, Dick," said Gary. "It's me, Gary."
Gary sat a few desks down from Richard. He waved at Richard from his own, gleamingly troll-free desk.
"Are we still on for drinks? You said we could go over the Merstham account."
"Oh, get off the bloody phone, Gary. Of course we are."
Richard put down the phone. There was a telephone number at the bottom of the post-it note. Richard had written the post-it note to himself several weeks earlier, and he had made the reservation. He was almost certain of that, but he had not confirmed it. He had kept meaning to, but there had been so much to do, and Richard had known that there was plenty of time. But events run in packs. Sylvia was now standing next to him.
"Dick, the Wandsworth report?"
"Almost ready, Sylvia. Look, just hold on a sec, can you?"
He finished punching in the number, breathed a sigh of relief when somebody answered,
"Ma maison, can I help you?"
"Yes," said Richard. "A table for three for tonight. I think I booked it. And if I did, I'm confirming the reservation. And if I didn't, I wondered if I could book it. Please."
No, they had no record of a table for tonight in the name of Mayhew, or Stockton, or Bartram, Jessica's surname. And as for booking a table, it wasn't the words that Richard found so unpleasant. It was the tone of voice in which the information was transmitted.
"A table for tonight should certainly have been booked years before, perhaps," it was implied, "by Richard's parents. A table for tonight was impossible. If the Pope, the Prime Minister, and the President of France arrived this evening without a confirmed reservation, even they would be turned out into the street with a continental jeer. But it's for my fiancé's boss. I know I should have phoned before. There are only three of us. Can't you please?"
They had put down the phone. "Richard," said Sylvia, "the MD's waiting."
"Do you think," asked Richard, "they'd give me a table if I phoned back and offered them extra money?"